So, three great continental plates. So mathematical formalism, ontology, and operationalism. And so mathematical formalization, of course, is, you know, whatever you use to write down your theory. Operationalism is the world of outcomes and knob settings and so on, the stuff that happens in a laboratory. And ontology is sort of the underlying reality, the stuff that's real. And in the classical days, the days of classical physics, these three things were kind of simple, that you just looked at the world, and what you saw was what was real, and you wrote it down mathematically. And these three continental plates got torn apart by the sort of powerful tectonic forces of quantum theory, and also, I would argue, general relativity. And so this is where we find ourselves. And the research I've been doing over the last almost 15 years has concerned thinking about operational description, operational description. And using that to try and build mathematical frameworks. The hope is, in the long run, that we'll also solve this sort of ontology problems. But that's a long-term goal. So I started this kind of approach back in 2001. And actually, Marcus just spoke about this kind of approach. So I was thinking about if you have something like this, you have a preparation, transformation, and a measurement. Back in 2001, I considered this kind of general framework for physical theories and then how to formulate quantum theory in it. Of course, I don't have time to go into details about this, but one thing that's important, again, Marcus touched on this, is if you have, in quantum theory, if you have a density matrix, say for a spin half particle, so it looks like that. Well, there's a linear relationship between that object and this object. So this is a list of the probabilities associated with spin up along the x, along the y, and along the z direction, as well as spin down along the z direction. If you know these four numbers, then you can calculate the four real numbers that appear inside the density matrix and vice versa. And this is linear. And if you have a formula like this in quantum theory, so you have some density matrix, you submit it to a some evolution under a completely positive map. This is the generalization of unitary evolution when you have mixing processes. And then you perform a measurement. So preparation is the density matrix. The transformation is associated with the CP map, the dollar sign. And the measurement is this operator. You can write this kind of equation down like this. So P is a list of probabilities. Z is a matrix that transforms this list of probabilities to a new list of probabilities. So the state goes in here, comes out here. And R is a vector associated with the measurement outcome. Okay.
Just do my shoelace.
I don't want to trip over. Okay. So over here we have this more general language. It's a language for operational theories because we're talking about outcomes and and so on, and usually goes by the name of GPT, generalized probability theories. And you can formulate not just quantum theory in this kind of language, but more general theories, as Marcus said. And it's clearly much better, if you're interested in the class of physical theories, it's clearly a much better sort of place to start, because it's not tied to the mathematical objects that appear in the quantum formalism. You know, things like density matrices and the other things that appear in the quantum formalism are very much tied to quantum theory. And if you're interested in going beyond quantum theory, it's better to work in this kind of framework. The other thing I want to emphasize is that this approach is linear in probability. Most of theoretical physics is done with objects, amplitudes, or states that belong to Hilbert space, and they are, so to speak, square root in probability. From a conceptual point of view, certainly if you're interested in general physical theories or framework physical theories, it's much better to work with objects that are linear in probability, and you can formulate quantum theory in these terms. Certainly that came as a surprise to me when I realized actually you can just write down lists of probability and work with things that are linear in them.
Marcus mentioned that you have a notion of state.
This is the notion of state.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So in this case, so you can just see this works here. You have a qubit that lives in a two-dimensional Hilbert space. You have two. The number of distinguishable states, the number of reliably distinguishable states is two. And the number of parameters you require to specify this is four.
I know, but in this case, you are not in quantum theory.
So then it could be more.
What do you mean by state?
Well, a state is still an object like this, a list of probabilities.
Oh, okay, yes, this relation n to the square. So the number n.
Oh, the number n is operationally defined. I'm not going to talk about that here because it's not relevant to this, but it's operationally defined as the maximum number of preparations you can reliably distinguish. Okay, so with probability 1 or 0, you can. Okay, and k is the number of probabilities that appear in this list. That's a more natural concept in some sense. It's the dimension of your space. So I did this back in 2001, and in the conclusion of the paper, I sort of asked myself what this was good for. And what I hoped was that it would solve the interpretation problem, that it would suggest a natural way to interpret quantum theory. Although it didn't really do that, and in the years since, it also hasn't really done that. It hasn't really shed any light on this corner of this continental plate. But the other thing I thought was maybe it would help with moving beyond quantum theory, in particular to a theory of quantum gravity. And unfortunately, in 2002, I came to Parameter Institute, where quantum gravity was an active area of concern. So what this raises is the possibility of an operational approach to quantum gravity, where you're thinking in terms of these generalized probability theories, this general framework of physical theories that are not tied to the quantum formalism. Now, unfortunately, it turns out that this particular framework that I've given you here is a bit too naive. It has a very simple notion of time, of background time, and so it doesn't really seem to be suitable to the problem of quantum gravity. But before I talk about that in any more detail, let me say what I think the problem of quantum gravity is. What we're doing is we're trying to find a physical theory.
Sorry, Lucian, can I just ask some?
Sure.
So this is not restricted to spin 1/2, right? It's something in any quantum system. So what do I think of this in quantum field theory? Is there an analog?
Well, so in quantum field theory, you have a problem because you have continuous dimensional Hilbert spaces, or at least infinite dimensional.
But at least formal. Is there a way of writing something?
Well, so maybe later I have some ideas about how you would take this over to quantum field theory. I can, if I get to that, I'll tell you about it. But it,
And if you put things on a lattice, then you could do it. Right?
You could do it on a lattice, perhaps, yeah, yeah. So there is a way to suggest it later in the talk, and it fits within this sort of generalized probability theory approach. Okay, so yeah, so the problem of quantum gravity is you're trying to find some as yet unknown theory that reduces inappropriate limits to general relativity on the one hand and quantum theory on the other hand. So it's worth looking at these two less fundamental theories and trying to get some clues as to how we're going to get to the more fundamental theory. So general relativity has radical and conservative features. So the conservative feature is that it's deterministic. It has a radical feature, which is that the causal structure is dynamic. It's a bit like trying to drive around Waterloo. You never know which roads are going to be open, but it seems like there's some connection between the route you're going to take and the sort of distribution of construction workers. So on the other hand, quantum theory has fixed causal structure, but it is inherently probabilistic. So it seems reasonable that we should take the radical features in each case. So what I did in 2005 was try to find an operational framework that was hospitable to both this radical feature, having dynamical causal structure, and this one. So this would be a general framework, more general than this kind of framework, in which you might have these features. Actually, it seems like it should be a bit more radical still, because in general relativity, although the causal structure isn't fixed in advance, once you solve for the equations, you have a given causal structure. You just have to solve for it. Whereas you suspect in quantum gravity, you'll have something like a superposition of different causal structures. You'll have something like indefinite causal structure. There'll be no matter of the fact as to whether the causal structure is one way or the other. So the causal load. So the framework I developed, I called it the causaloid framework. Because whenever I have a new approach, I like to celebrate by inventing a new word. So the idea of this framework is it's a framework like this. But it doesn't require a sort of fixed background time. It admits indefinite causal structure. You can, if you think about it, one of the key challenges here is that if you no longer have a definite causal structure, if you have something like indefinite causal structure, then you can't think in terms of foliating your space into space-like hypersurfaces, because any interval along a space-like hypersurface is, any small interval anyway like this, is space-like. If we have indefinite causal structure in general, then intervals in general will not be either space-like or time-like. They may be something more general. So the whole picture of having a foliation like this may not go through. Okay. So once I got this causaloid framework, which I'll talk a little bit about, the challenge was then to see if we could formulate quantum theory in it on the one hand and general relativity on the other hand. So I showed how to formulate quantum theory in this framework, but I wasn't able to formulate general relativity in the framework at the time. Once I'd got quantum theory in here, so this has to be a formulation that doesn't use a background time. There were some further developments. So I have something called the operator tensor.
formulation of quantum theory. And actually, this would be a good starting point for an approach to quantum field theory. One feature that came out of this is that there's kind of a missing ingredient here, which I'll also talk about if I have time, which is that the way you put together the operational objects, the way you compose your objects is important. And the missing ingredient is something I've called the composition principle. So I'll come back to that. So here's the basic idea of the causaloid framework. You define some operational space. So points in this space are fixed by things you see in the laboratory. That's what I mean by operational. So basically outcomes. And then you define, you have regions in this space. Now you can associate with each of these regions, you can associate vectors, which are like the vectors I talked about over there. They're essentially linearly related to lists of probabilities.
So these vectors for the region or for a point in the region?
They're for the whole region, yeah. Yeah, and then the challenge becomes to find, if you have a region AB, I want to be able to write down the vector for that in terms of a special product, which I called the causaloid product. And this is basically a bilinear product on these lists. And these lists are related to their linear improbabilities. So you have an operational space.
What do you mean by operational?
Right, yeah. So there's a funny thing here because this is kind of abstract in a certain way, that I'm sort of talking in an abstract way about sort of something which is very concrete, which are experiments.
Yeah.
And whenever an experimentalist does an experiment, they record things like data on pieces of paper. They say, well, this happened in coincidence with this and things of that sort. So you can, and in the paper, I go into great detail about how to build up an operational space like this, which is built out of the stuff that the experimentalist sees.
I see. So this is a local operation, let's call it
In some sense, you might think that each of these corresponds to some observation.
Some observation,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then these are like, when you say there's a region, does the thing a single measurement, or is it include like
I'm trying to give in 15 minutes or whatever. But it's a good question. It's an essential question, in fact. Yeah. So it's something. This is the space that the experimentalist lives in, his lab book, his notebook. Puts points in this
no,
in this
I'm
space.
To make the connection what you were saying before about the
causaloid. Yeah. So. Yeah, so what I did in this paper was I went into great detail about how you might imagine doing an experiment in general and collecting little bits of data on cards. And at the end of the experiment, you'd have a stack of cards.
But you don't care how they are ordered in time.
Exactly, you don't care about that, yeah, yeah. All that's important is that each of these cards, these cards will correspond to points in this operational space. So it's sort of meant to be very abstract. You know, it's in the spirit of, you know, computer scientists often try to be very abstract. They talk about general machines. It's in that kind of spirit, just talking very abstract ways about what experiments are like and form an operational space. And
so, for example, if there are 10 possible outcomes,
yeah.
And assume it's discrete, then you would have the space would consist of the count with the outcomes. The vector would be a vector with 10 elements, each element an integer, counting.
Yeah, I guess in that case. Yeah.
Example.
But more interesting experiments may have more complicated structure that get mapped into this space. So what was, I need a drink of water. So what was interesting was that in quantum theory, quantum theory, the idea here was to take a very try to treat different causal situations on the same footing. So you always use the same product, regardless of the causal situation, wherever these regions are. Because some parameters in this outcome space, in this operational space, will correspond to time. But regardless of the causal relationship of these things, you have the same product. Of course, the parameters inside here will depend on the causal structure of these things, but you're treating them in the same mathematical way. It's always a bilinear product.
Does it assume that A and B can interact and exchange information of some sort?
Well, you're just talking about data, and you're interested in calculating probabilities within this data. So interaction is a different kind of level of concept, I think. But anyway, what's interesting, if you look at quantum theory, just to maybe give you a, here's an example of something you might consider in quantum theory. Here's two qubits that are passing through these various gates. You might be interested in this region and this region, which would get mapped into this space. And then you would, the product you would use would just be the tensor product. Okay. But you might be interested in this region here. And then the product you'd use would just be the direct product of these operators. Or you might even be interested in this region, consisting of D and B. And you can define an object which is like this. So this object is defined to have the property that when it acts on something like C, it returns DCB. So this is also a linear operator. But what you see is each of these different causal situations is treated in quantum theory in a different way. In this framework, every causal situation is treated in the same way. So that seems like it's more hospitable to a theory of quantum gravity, where the causal structure is something dynamical. You can't say that I'm going to treat space-like separated situations in one way and time-like in another way if you don't have definite causal structure. So that was the idea. How am I doing for time, Lee? Okay. So, yeah. So maybe I'll go on for another 5 minutes.
I'm lost in this point here. So how does suddenly probabilities become linear? I'm just confused.
Well,
here we have A, dollar, and rho, and then below we have R, Z, and P. Right?
Yeah.
So is it true that R only depends on A, Z, on dollar sign, and rho?
Yeah. No, look at this here. This is a density matrix. Density matrix is linear in probabilities. It surprised me when I first saw it, and so it's not. If you haven't seen it before, it is surprising, but it's true that you can reformulate quantum theory in this language of things that are linear in probabilities.
I have an operator that describes evolution, which is instead of e to the I Hamiltonian, I have some other operator, this is Z.
Yeah.
And I act with Z on probabilities, and then for each operator, I construct an R that is independent of the state.
Yeah.
The state?
Yeah, you can do this, yeah. All this
can. Very cute. Can you give a simple example? I don't know, unless people.
Maybe we should talk later, because it gets into the. Maybe I can sit down and show you more detail, but it really does map into this linear language, which clearly is a better starting point if you want to go beyond quantum theory. Okay, so I have a few minutes. What shall I do? No, there's no questions. So I'll just try and say what I want to say. So I said that motivated by this causal loop framework, where we try to put different causal structures on the same footing in the way that I talked about there, there's this thing called the operator tensor framework. And the idea here is that you have something like this. This is a this is an operation. So some box in the laboratory that has inputs, different types of system, like A might be an electron, B could be a photon, and so on. And so this is an object in the laboratory. It belongs to the operational description of the world. And we can associate with this an operator. And this is an operator, an Hermitian operator that acts on a Hilbert space. And the Hilbert space is given by looking at the legs coming into and going out of this. And what we can show is that the probability for any circuit, so here's an example of a circuit, okay. This is a circuit. So what the experimentalist has done, this is a description of something the experimentalist has done. He's wired together various boxes, allowing systems coming out of this aperture to go into that aperture and so on. And each of these boxes may have outcomes on them, so lights that flash. And so we're considering a particular sequence of lights, a particular pattern of light flashes, like a certain light flashes here, say the green light. Here the blue light, here the red light, here the purple light.
You assume
a particular sequence in time? No, sorry, I misspoke. I didn't mean to use the word sequence. A particular pattern of light flashes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a, given everything I've said, that was a missing. And what you can do is you can write this down by a mathematical expression that looks like this, sorry. I'm going to put double borders around these. So this is a mathematical object. This is an operator. I'm using Penrose diagrammatic style notation, but for operators instead of for tensors. You can write this down by a diagram. It looks exactly the same as the diagram describing the circuit. Except that now these are mathematical objects. This is a mathematical calculation. And this is a description of an experiment. So I'm not going to tell you how you do this calculation, but basically when you have a wire between two boxes, that indicates the partial trace over an appropriate part of the operator space. So incidentally, if I wanted to go to quantum field theory, this would be a good starting point, because you can imagine building a big circuit that sort of approximated something like space-time and perhaps take the continuum limit. But what's interesting is that I don't have to use any foliation in doing this calculation. So you don't have to assume any particular foliation. And that's a good thing, because any given circuit can be foliated in lots of different ways, especially as you get more complicated circuits. No, this isn't a causal set. I mean, well, so these graphs have to be directed acyclic graphs, because you don't want things going backwards in time. But it's not a causal set in the sense of what Raphael does.
But isn't this causal connections that those
yeah.
are operators?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, these are wires in a laboratory, if you like, where you connect apertures in a laboratory.
But information goes one way in the
wire. Yes, that's right, yeah. So all I'm trying to do here is reformulate quantum theory, which, remember, does have some fixed causal structure in the background. But I'm trying to do it in a way that doesn't use background time.
Should we worry that you don't show us the wires by which these lights get light, by which we see these lights, that there are wires that take the photons to
right. Yeah, in these sort of operational approaches, there's always a point at which you say, well, now I've got some piece of data, and I'm not going to worry about what happens to it afterwards. And you can put that point where you want. You know, that's the sort of Heisenberg cut. So I imagine that, you know, once the light has flashed and it's been recorded, it doesn't really matter what happens. You're no longer interested in physics, but in data transmission. So the missing ingredient, the thing that seems to be important here, is that you have this way of doing physics where you give an operational description of your experiment. And then you can write down a calculation that has the same compositional structure. So I call this the composition principle. In fact, I thought I might call it the principle of general compositionality. So this is meant to be similar to the principle of general covariance. So here's the principle of general compositionality. The laws of physics should be written in such a way that they apply to any compositional structure of any object and in terms of calculations having the same compositional structure as this description. So it's sort of a very general principle you could imagine that you say, well, your mathematical theory has to have the same structure as the compositional description of your object. And it turns out you can do that in this case of circuits. So it seems like a very good principle to elevate, use more generally. So what I've been doing recently that I'm not going to talk about in any detail because we're way over time. So, yeah, I'll just say what I've been doing without talking about it in any detail. What I've been doing recently is trying to put general relativity into this framework. And this composition principle seems to be an important clue to tell you how to do that. And all I want to do here is actually, it's a very conservative goal. I just want to take standard general relativity as it is and put it into a framework where I allow ignorance probabilities. I also allow settings, so different knob settings. And I want to do it in a way that's operational. So I need to choose the right operational space. And the hope is, I have a pretty clear idea how to do that. And the paper is currently being written up. But the idea is that once you have this and this that are formulated in the same kind of framework, then you'll be in a much better position to bring those two theories together and get a theory of quantum gravity. So, yeah, that's it.